All right, welcome in everyone to another deep dive. Today we're going to be talking about, well, I guess you could say the roots of Puritanism, huh? Those like early church movements in England that eventually like made their way over to America. And we've got some pretty fascinating source material for this one.
Yeah, we do.
We're primarily going to be looking at excerpts from a lecture by Dr. Roger Green. It's on the English Reformation. So really our mission today is to kind of try to understand these big religious changes going on in England leading up to Puritanism, and then, what were the real motivations for all these different groups that were seeking religious freedom,
Yeah, and I think what we're going to see is that history and theology are just so interwoven. They're just so intertwined in this period. So we'll be talking about some of the key turning points, some of the key individuals that kind of laid the groundwork for all of this.
And it's really interesting to see how, like, where geographically, where that theological kind of like center was, Initially it was like in Germany, right, with Luther, and then it was kind of Switzerland with Calvin. And then, as we'll see during this deep dive, England really becomes this huge center for theological development.
Absolutely. And what's so striking about England is what we might call the pendulum shift, back and forth between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. So you see this throughout this period. And, to really understand the context here, it helps to go back even further, even before, the Reformation as we typically think of it. Dr. Green talks about John Wycliffe as kind of this key figure, often called the morning star of the Reformation.
Oh wow, that's a really cool like image. Yeah, really is.
And what's interesting is that Wycliffe is, even before some of the more well-known reformers like Luther, already voicing some pretty significant criticisms against the church.
Really?
Yeah, he's really doing some groundbreaking work, especially in translating the Bible into English. So this is really, revolutionary at the time. It's empowering people to read the scriptures for themselves. And, it's laying the groundwork for really challenging the church's authority.
Wow. So this is like kind of setting the scene for what's going to happen
It
later.
really is. He's preparing the soil, so to speak.
So I guess to really kind of dive into this, we should look at the history of England, the religious history of England, and we'll do that through the different monarchs, starting with the very famous Henry VIII, 1509 to 1547. Now, this is kind of a fun fact. In 1521, the Pope actually gave Henry the title Defender of the Faith.
Isn't that ironic?
I know, right? It's almost funny now knowing what happens later.
Yeah, talk about a twist of fate, right?
Yeah, but at the time, that title was given to him because he had written in defense of the Catholic Church against Martin Luther. So initially, he was like a staunch advocate, for the Catholic faith. But as we'll see, that changes pretty dramatically in just a few years.
Yeah, just a decade or so later, things change completely.
So around 1534, things kind of take a turn. He basically breaks with the Roman Catholic Church. But it's really important to note that, Dr. Green points out that this break, it wasn't like this sudden theological, revelation, was it? Like he hadn't had some kind of like big spiritual awakening. It was really more personal political stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, primarily his motivation was he wanted to get an annulment from Catherine of Aragon so that he could marry Anne Boleyn. And when the Pope refused to grant that annulment, well, Henry asserted English sovereignty. He didn't like this idea of a foreign power kind of dictating to him. So he declared himself the head of the Church of England. So yeah, it's really about power and it's really about politics. It's about national identity, England kind of coming into its own.
Now here's where it gets even more interesting, right? I mean, you've got this huge break. The Pope excommunicates him, but Henry himself remains largely Roman Catholic in his theology.
It really is quite a contradiction.
I mean, he even wrote the Six Articles, which Dr. Green points out really just uphold Catholic doctrine. So it's almost like you've got the head of the church in England in open defiance of Rome, but still holding to like Catholic beliefs.
Yeah, it's a real balancing act, isn't it? It shows that this first phase of the English Reformation wasn't really about adopting Protestant theology. It was really about Henry, changing the structure. And so he dismantles a lot of that Roman Catholic structure, within England.
Yeah, and like for example, the monasteries,
Right, right.
he like dissolved them, which Dr. Green calls a real tragedy. And
Yes.
it's kind of easy to see why, because they weren't just religious sites.
Right.
They were like centers of learning. They were, supporting art. They're even doing like social support type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So destroying them, I mean, it was a huge cultural loss.
It was.
But at the same time, it significantly reduced the Pope's power in England, So
Right.
it's kind of this paradoxical thing, You've got this king, he's defying the Pope, he's completely reshaping the church,
Yeah.
but he's still holding on to a lot of the Catholic beliefs. And it's what Dr. Green calls a really rocky beginning.
Yeah, a very rocky beginning for the Reformation in England.
Right.
So it's really a Reformation driven by, the monarch's will and political necessity.
Right.
Not so much by theological change, at least not at first.
Right.
But this kind of sets the stage for what comes next.
Yeah.
With his successors, we really start to see more of those theological shifts.
Right. Well, the next in line is Edward VI, who reigned for a very short period from 1547 to 1553.
Right.
And it's under Edward that the pendulum really swings more in favor of the Reformation.
Right.
And even though he died really young, he was only 16, his reign saw some really significant changes that really moved the Church of England closer to Protestantism.
Absolutely. And Dr. Green points to four key transformations during this time.
Okay.
The first is the removal of images from churches.
Okay.
So this was a really deliberate move away from practices that were common in Roman Catholicism,
Right.
where images held a more central place in worship.
Okay, interesting. What else?
Yeah, so the second big change, and this is a huge step towards making religion more accessible, is they started having worship services in English.
Oh, wow.
So not Latin anymore,
Okay.
the language of the people.
So everyone can understand.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, this really mirrors what Luther and Calvin were doing in their areas
Okay.
to try to make the scriptures and the liturgy understandable.
Okay.
Okay, so the third big change is that they allowed priests to marry,
Oh,
which
okay.
was a big break from the Roman Catholic Church, where
Right.
celibacy was required.
Right.
And this was something that was really reinforced at the Council of Trent.
Okay, and what was that fourth change?
The fourth major change was opening up communion to the laity.
Oh,
So,
okay.
the Roman Catholic practice at the time, the laity, they would typically only receive the bread during communion,
Okay, yeah.
and only the priest would take the wine.
Right.
But under Edward, the laity were now permitted to receive both bread and wine.
Okay.
So it signifies a much fuller participation in the
Gotcha.
sacraments.
So it's like they're really making some serious changes here.
Yeah, big changes. Moving the Church of England in a very Protestant direction. And this was really aided by some strong leadership within the church during this time. Dr. Green points to three key individuals. You've got Thomas Cranmer, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he played a huge role in moving the Reformation forward in England, from the very influential position. Then you got Nicholas Ridley, who was a well-respected scholar at Oxford. And he really boosted the intellectual foundation of the English Reformation. And then you get Hugh Latimer, who was a powerful preacher, really charismatic. And Dr. Green suggests that he must have been a really compelling figure, drawing people to this new reformed faith through his sermons.
So you've got like Cranmer, he's the administrator, kind of giving the direction.
Right.
And then you've got Ridley, he's like the brain.
This scholar, yeah.
And then Latimer is kind of like the
Yeah.
heart,
Yeah. The one winning people over. Yeah. And because of this leadership and the whole religious atmosphere under Edward, England actually became this place where reformers from across Europe would come seeking refuge. They were drawn to figures like Cranmer and Ridley and Latimer, wanting to learn from them, participate in this burgeoning Reformation. And, what's really important here and what Dr. Green points out is that, the kind of theological orientation of these reformers was largely Calvinistic. And this is going to be key for understanding Puritanism later on.
Okay, so what does that mean? When we talk about like Calvinistic principles,
Right.
for the Puritans, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so generally speaking, we're talking about a very strong emphasis on the authority of Scripture in all areas of church life, and a desire for a simpler, less ornate form of worship.
Okay.
So really focusing on the essentials.
Gotcha.
Stripping away anything that they saw as unnecessary.
Right, right. Okay, so that's an important thing to keep in mind as we move forward.
Absolutely.
But of course, you know, like we've said, this Protestant kind of movement, it doesn't last.
Right.
Edward dies, you know, young.
Yeah.
And his half-sister Mary, who's a devout Roman Catholic, she causes the throne in 1553.
Right.
And it's like the pendulum swings right back. Yeah.
In the other direction.
It does. And so Mary, who reigns until 1558, is really committed to restoring Roman Catholicism.
Okay.
As the dominant faith.
Right.
And Dr. Green uses really strong language here to describe her. He calls her very bigoted, very intolerant.
Wow.
In her religious convictions.
Wow.
And her methods for trying to achieve those religious aims were pretty extreme.
Yeah. And this is where we get to like a really dark chapter in English history, right?
It is.
Where Mary is trying to bring back Catholicism.
Yeah.
And she persecutes the Protestants.
Yeah.
And Dr. Green estimates that something like 200 people were burned at the stake during her reign.
It's horrific.
I know. It's awful. It's just awful.
And among those who were martyred during this time were those key figures we talked about. Cranmer, Ridley, and Latimer.
Oh. And Dr. Green recounts this really powerful story about Latimer. As he and Ridley are being tied to the stake, Latimer says to Ridley, "Be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out."
Wow, that's amazing.
It really is a testament to their conviction.
Yeah.
And their courage.
Yeah.
In the face of certain death.
Yeah.
And Dr. Green mentions that in Oxford, there's actually a memorial.
Oh, wow.
In commemorating the burning of Ridley and Latimer.
Yeah.
And there's a statue there. And it's not completely historically accurate because it shows Cranmer being burned with them.
Okay.
But, you know, it still serves as this powerful reminder of these events.
Yeah. And knowing those physical reminders are there really makes it feel real, you know?
It does.
And it's not surprising that Mary became this hated and feared woman.
Right.
I mean, you can understand why.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Protestants, that they ended up fleeing to Europe during her reign, you know? Seeking exile.
Right. And, you know, just think about the courage it took for them to do that, to leave everything behind.
Yeah.
You know, just for their beliefs. I mean, it's something that, unfortunately, people still face in many parts of the world today.
It is. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because even though Mary was trying so hard to reverse the Reformation, Dr. Green suggests that her actions may have actually strengthened the Protestant cause in the long run.
Oh, how so?
Well, because of those images of martyrdom.
Oh, right.
And because of the resilience of those who held on to their faith.
Yeah.
Even in the face of such persecution.
Right, right. Okay. But as we all know, the pendulum is going to swing again, right?
That's right.
When Mary dies in 1558,
yeah.
Elizabeth I, her half-sister, she takes the throne.
Right.
And this marks the beginning of a very long and very influential reign. It lasts until 1603. And it's during this time that we see a much more firm reestablishment of Protestantism in England. Yes, and Queen Elizabeth, she takes a very different approach than her predecessors.
Okay.
She's definitely Protestant.
Okay.
But she wants a more stable and a more unifying settlement.
Okay.
And so Dr. Green points out four ways that she really solidified the Reformation in England.
Okay.
Firstly, she replaced all those Catholic leaders within the church with Protestant leaders.
Yeah.
But what's important is she did this without resorting to that kind of violent persecution.
Right.
That we saw under Mary.
So it was much more like strategic.
Much more strategic, yeah.
Okay.
Secondly, she established two foundational documents for the Church of England.
Okay.
You have the 39 Articles.
Okay.
Which really defines the theological tenets of Anglicanism. These were finalized in 1571.
Okay.
And then you have the Book of Common Prayer.
Okay.
Which provides a structure for liturgy.
Right.
And worship practices. So these are, you know, providing this clear and lasting structure.
Right.
For this Reformed English Church.
Yeah.
And thirdly, Elizabeth assumed the title Supreme Governor of the Church of England.
Oh, okay. So not head.
Right. Not head, which is what her father had used.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dr. Green explains that the Archbishop of Canterbury is still considered the head of the church.
Okay.
In a spiritual sense.
Right.
But the monarch, even today, plays this really important role.
Okay.
Like in the appointment of the Archbishop through that title.
Wow. So that's a connection that just continues to this day.
It really is.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And then fourthly, Elizabeth established the hierarchical structure and liturgy of the Church of England. And what's key here is that she intentionally sought kind of a middle ground.
Oh, okay.
Between Roman Catholicism and those more radical forms of Protestantism, especially Calvinism.
Okay.
So this was a way to try to create a church that could hold together these very different views.
Right.
And it was meant to promote stability.
Right.
You know, after decades of upheaval.
Yeah.
So how do you see that? This middle ground? Was this like a brilliant move?
Yeah, that's fascinating because, you know, Dr. Green talks about this middle ground being kind of characterized by its appeal to scripture.
Right.
It's rooted in early church tradition, hence the Catholic element.
Yeah.
And its emphasis on reason.
Right.
But it's almost like in trying to balance things, she ends up not really satisfying either extreme.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so the Catholics are like, well, you haven't gone far enough.
Right.
We need to go back to the old ways.
Right.
And then the Protestants, especially the Calvinists, they're like, well, you haven't gotten rid of enough of that Catholic stuff.
Right, exactly.
And it just highlights how difficult religious compromise is.
It really does. Hmm. It makes you wonder, was this a stroke of genius for long-term stability? Or did it kind of set the stage for more conflict down the road?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good question. And Dr. Green mentions how later on, John Wesley would add, you know, experience to these characteristics, you know, alongside scripture, tradition, and reason.
Right.
Which kind of shows how, you know, theological thought was still developing,
right,
you know, within Anglicanism.
Yeah. And what Elizabeth had established was really a church with a wide range of practices.
Right.
From the more evangelical to the very liturgical.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that still defines the Anglican church today.
Okay, so after all this back and forth, all this tumult,
right,
you know, with the pendulum swinging back and forth,
yeah,
Elizabeth finally establishes this, like, relatively stable Protestant Church of England.
Right, right.
But this isn't the end of the story.
Of course not.
Because there are groups within the church that are still dissenting.
Yeah.
And this kind of brings us to, well, the development of Congregationalism.
Right.
And the Baptists. But for this section, we're going to focus primarily on Congregationalism.
Okay.
And kind of do it through the lens of the Puritans.
Right, right.
So who are the Puritans?
Well, Dr. Green defines them as those within the Anglican Church.
Okay.
Who wanted to purify it.
Okay.
Based on Calvinistic principles.
Okay.
Of church order.
Okay.
And it's important to understand that at first, they didn't want to leave the church.
Right.
They wanted to reform it from within.
Right.
And they often looked to Parliament to try to enact these changes, even if Queen Elizabeth wasn't necessarily on board.
Okay, interesting. So the Dr. Green also says that their main focus was ecclesiology.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So that's essentially the study of the church.
Sure.
Its structure, its governance,
right,
its practices.
Okay. Gotcha.
And this really represents a bit of a shift in theological focus.
Oh, how so?
Well, yeah, the Reformation initially was all about salvation,
right,
and assurance.
Yeah.
But now the Puritans are really concerned with the practical outworking of faith.
Right.
In the life of the church.
Right. Okay.
How do we actually live this out?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. So what were their disagreements with the Anglican church?
Right. So there were two main areas of disagreement.
Okay.
First, liturgy.
Okay.
The Puritans, they wanted a much simpler form of worship.
Okay.
Much more focused on scripture.
Okay.
And they felt like the existing liturgy was too Roman Catholic.
Oh, okay.
It had all these rituals. The priests had to wear special clothes. They used incense. They still had the mass.
Right, right.
So the Puritans wanted to get rid of all that.
Okay.
And then the second disagreement was about church polity.
Okay.
So that's how the church is governed.
Okay.
And they didn't like the hierarchical system of the Church of England.
Oh, okay.
You know, with the archbishops, the bishops, the priests, the laity. They felt like it wasn't biblical. And they preferred a system where the church was run more by, you know, the congregation.
Right, right.
By the laity.
Yeah.
So this is really kind of foreshadowing the development of Congregationalism.
Right.
But it's important to remember that, you know, at this point, they still want to be part of the church.
They're not breaking away.
They're not breaking away. They're trying to reform it from within.
Right, right. Okay, so now, alongside the Puritans, we've got another movement popping up.
Right.
It's called the English Independent Movement.
Yeah.
And they're sometimes referred to as the Brownists.
Yeah.
After one of their key leaders, Robert Brown and Harrison.
Oh.
Okay.
And this group, they were a little more radical.
Okay, so how were they different from the Puritans?
Well, unlike the Puritans who, you know, wanted to reform the Church of England,
yeah,
the Independents believed they had to separate.
Really?
Completely.
Wow.
They felt like the Church of England was just beyond saving.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine this was considered pretty heretical.
Yeah.
By the established church.
Right, right. Okay, so what did their worship look like?
Yeah, so their worship services were very simple.
Okay.
Both in terms of the liturgy.
Right.
And the church governance.
Okay.
And they often had lay leadership.
Okay.
And not necessarily ordained clergy.
Gotcha.
And as you can imagine, these separatist beliefs led to some persecution in England.
Yeah.
So they faced a lot of pressure, a lot of opposition.
Right.
And often had to flee.
Oh, wow.
And they found refuge in the Netherlands.
Okay.
Which was, at the time, known for its religious tolerance.
Okay.
So it's interesting, right? You see these different levels of religious freedom
right.
across Europe.
Right, yeah. Okay, so what happened to this group, the Brownists?
Yeah, so Dr. Green notes that they eventually kind of faded out.
Okay.
But the broader independent movement,
okay.
it persisted.
Okay.
And it's from these independent or separatist roots that we see the Pilgrims emerge.
Oh.
So they're the ones who would eventually make their way to America.
Right, right.
And these were individuals who had already separated from the church.
Yeah.
They were looking for a place where they could practice their faith.
Right.
According to their own understanding.
Right.
Without interference.
Right. And so that leads us to the Mayflower.
Yeah.
1620.
1620, you got it.
That journey across the Atlantic.
Right.
Seeking that religious freedom in the New World. I mean, that's a foundational story in American history.
It is.
And who were their main leaders?
Yeah, so you've got William Brewster.
Okay.
Who's often referred to as the Elder.
Okay.
And he was really their spiritual guide.
Okay.
And, you know, that title, Elder, comes from the Bible.
Right.
Reflects their Congregationalist leanings.
Okay.
And then you've got William Bradford.
Okay.
Who is their political leader.
Okay.
The first governor of the Plymouth colony.
Gotcha.
And they landed in Plymouth, yeah. established this community
yeah.
with that Congregationalist form of church governance.
Right.
Where each local church basically governs itself.
Right.
Accountable to Christ.
Right.
Not to some distant hierarchy.
Right.
And Dr. Green actually encourages people to visit Plymouth Plantation today. Yeah. He says it's this really immersive historical experience.
That's awesome. Yeah. And he also mentions that Plymouth Rock itself is actually pretty small.
Yeah, it is.
Which I always thought was kind of funny.
I know. You think it'd be bigger.
You think it'd be this huge rock, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah. And he also tells this funny story about, you know, a visitor from Tokyo who was visiting Plymouth Plantation and didn't realize that the interpreters there were speaking in 17th century English.
Oh, wow.
So they thought they just had really strong accents.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's like they're really committed to the
yeah.
historical experience.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, so the Pilgrims, they were separatists.
But then the next wave of Puritan immigration to America, which peaked around 1628, these were people who were
right?
still technically members of the Church of England.
Yeah.
But they had, like, you know, strong Puritan beliefs
right.
and Calvinist beliefs.
Right.
Right. So it's really important to remember that difference.
Yeah. That distinction is crucial.
Yeah.
For understanding this early history.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Dr. Green talks about some key leaders of these Puritan communities.
Right.
In New England, you've got John Cotton in Boston.
Yeah.
Richard Mather in Dorchester.
Right.
And Thomas Hooker, who led